KZSU FM Stanford, welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I'm an assistant professor of law at the Charlotte School of Law in Charlotte, North Carolina, as well as a non-resident fellow at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School. Thank you for joining today on Hearsay Culture. And today we turn and focus more heavily on technology than we have on the last few shows. I'm very pleased to have on Associate Professor of Law and Telecommunications at the University of Colorado Law School, Paul Ohm. And Paul has written a very interesting article, which is available on SSRN, called The Rise and Fall of Invasive ISP, Internet Service Provider Surveillance. So a very, very engaging title covering a very, very interesting area in technology and internet infrastructure. We've all heard the phrase, the name ISP, and we kind of know it as this vague entity that's helping us connect to various web pages. Certainly as consumers, we all need an ISP in order to access the internet. But what do ISPs do? What are they doing behind the scenes that we're not aware of? And there's an increasing focus in the technology world as well as the IP world on concerns involving privacy. Privacy issues relating to how much data is actually available to others without your permission, data that you may or may not want to be made public. How can that data be used? What is that data? What kind of information can be gleaned from it and so forth? And there have been some very high profile cases involving privacy issues, including the case that the Electronic Frontier Foundation brought against AT&T involving phone records that were given up to federal authorities in a alleged effort to get a hold on domestic terrorism, or in many other issues involving data that is shared or not shared through intermediaries being made public in ways that may or may not offend our traditional notions of what kind of privacy rights we have. But in Paul's piece, Paul takes a close look at this question of ISP surveillance, the ability of ISPs to actually monitor traffic that goes through their network and to use that information in ways that many of us really haven't thought about. In Paul's piece, he starts his abstract in a way that I think is a good way to start the discussion and really frames the issue. He says, quote, "Nothing in society poses as grave a threat to privacy as the internet service provider." Well, that's a very strong claim, but in a lengthy article, a very readable article, to be sure, but a lengthy article, Paul backs up that claim by going through how ISPs do what they do, how they monitor traffic, the law that's involved. He brings in current debates involving network neutrality, BitTorrent, and various other applications, and that some of which you may not be familiar with, that deal with moving data through the internet. He talks about privacy issues, aggregation, and so forth. And really, throughout this article, he brings a fair amount of information that would seem to be disparate together to draw a conclusion, ultimately, that says that there are changes that need to be made. So we're going to take an in-depth look at ISPs, and particularly their ability to surveil network traffic today on Hearsay Culture. So without any further introduction, Paul, thank you for joining me today on the show.
Thank you, Dave. It's my pleasure to be here.
What I usually do with all of my guests starting off, before we even get into even the title of the piece, is really to ask more about your background. So tell us a little bit more beyond what I said about your background and why you became interested in these kinds of issues.
I'd be happy to. I'm in my fourth year teaching here at the University of Colorado in Boulder at the law school. And prior to becoming an academic, I was a federal prosecutor at the U.S. Department of Justice. The Department of Justice has a unit in Washington, D.C. called the Computer Crime and Intellectual Property Section. And I can safely say, I can at least make the claim that it's probably the most interesting office in the country for a lawyer to get engaged with technology and the law and the intersection between the two. My good friends at the Electronic Frontier Foundation might have claims to that title, but this DOJ section is a fantastic place to encounter these issues. And while there, one of my main responsibilities was mastery of what we call the Electronic Communications Privacy Act, which is the 1986 law. It's been amended many times since then, which governs privacy with respect to internet service providers, websites, email providers, that kind of thing. And so it was really through that 4 years as a prosecutor trying to answer two questions. One, how does the government investigate crime online while respecting privacy? And two, when do private parties cross the line and violate the law? That got me interested kind of down the road that led to this paper. The last thing I'd say about my background is before the Department of Justice and before law school, I was a computer programmer and network systems administrator in California. I have an undergraduate degree in computer science, and to be honest, that's where my love still is. The law is great and fascinating and interesting and has gotten me to some amazing places to work. But at heart, I think I'm still a technologist and a computer programmer first and a lawyer second.
A lot of us in the cyber law community certainly would say that we are wannabe geeks, whereas you are, I think, fairly and said, of course, in fondness rather than pejorative nature, a real geek writing in this area. One of the challenges, which I do want to ask you about before we get into the paper, of course, is that very point. When we're writing about technology and we don't have a strong background in terms of education, in technology, it can be a bit of a challenge. Now, you've written a piece here, and you've written other pieces that cover technology in a high degree of detail, and yet you write them, I think, in an accessible way. What are the challenges, if any, that you find in merging your interest in law with your strong background in technology?
Well, I mean, you know, I think if someone asked me what I did for a living, I'd say I'm a translator, because that's the essence, I think, of what I try and do. I try and take complex technical topics and make them, as you say, accessible or approachable to the lay reader, and in particular the lay lawyer. That's really what I do. But it's hard. You're correct. It's hard to navigate. It's always about picking analogies, which is really kind of a fraught thing to do. People pick the wrong analogy, or they pick an analogy for the wrong reasons. That's always subject to debate. I'll expand on that a little bit. The mistake, I think, that's often made in the act of translation is the lawyers and the policymakers, when they are afraid of the complexity of the technology, will often become deferential to the technologists. And I don't mean to say that technologists shouldn't be listened to and respected. Of course they should. But they should also be pushed to be specific, to be concrete, and to help policymakers and non-technologists understand not just how the technology works, but the ramifications which flow from that. And so if you asked me, you know, what my scholarly agenda is, it kind of is to strip bare this tendency to defer a little too much to technology and to throw up our hands and say, well, we can't really regulate there, or we really can't talk about that because the technology is too complicated or it moves too quickly. I really do try and strike a blow against that attitude in a lot of what I write.
You know, and it's especially timely. I mean, we're recording the show on October 7th. Obviously, we're just a few weeks away from the presidential election, and while we don't hear a lot of discussion of technology issues, they, of course, are issues that certainly policymakers should be thinking about, and we're going to discuss a few of them today. But even taking a topic like network neutrality, which we're going to discuss in a while, well, that's gotten a little bit more attention. But even there's confusion as to what that exactly means. What do you have a sense or an opinion as to the general level of understanding among policymakers of technology issues?
You know, I'm, for one, I'm one who usually disagrees with those who say that policymakers are ill-equipped and do a very bad job of deciphering things, particularly things that happen on the Internet. I think there are two things that contribute to those instances where policymakers just botch it. The first is the advocates in front of them, the people who are supposed to do the translation, don't do a good enough job. And then the second thing is, like I said, they're just too tentative and afraid to ask the questions that they need to ask. But in certain circumstances, and I think the net neutrality may even be a good example of this, in certain circumstances, the advocates do a good job with translation, the policymakers do a good job asking the right questions, and you'll get these crystalline understandings of the technology that I think are quite good. I've never been one who says we need specialized judges hearing patent cases. I've never been one who says we need specialized agencies who do internet policy. By and large, judges and to a lesser extent policymakers tend to get where they get because they're intelligent people who understand complex things. I worked for two judges, for example, who are just two of the brightest people I've ever met before. And I have no doubt that they would understand any technology you put before them, so long as you do a good job and an honest job explaining the technology. So I always kind of place my bets and lay my side with the idea that policymakers can handle the complexity of technology.
The topic that we're discussing today, and really to begin our discussion of the topic, you titled your piece "The Rise and Fall of Invasive ISP Surveillance," which suggests, of course, that you're tracing a bit of a history, and you certainly do in the piece, talking about the capabilities of ISPs from the early stages to now to monitor network traffic. In order to get into these issues and to explore the topics that you discuss, I think it's useful for listeners that aren't familiar to get a general background on ISP. So let's start with a very basic question, which of course is, what is an ISP in a technical sense?
Right, and so there are many answers to that. I'll tell you the answer that I gave in my paper. So I'm focusing on a particular type of company that delivers data to the Internet and delivers data from the Internet to a customer who's connected to the Internet. So they're the gateway to the Internet. And so in concrete terms, the ISPs we think about when we think about ISPs are entities like the cable companies like Time Warner that provide cable modems, the phone companies like Verizon that provide DSL connections. Verizon, as is well known, is also now experimenting or implementing delivery of the Internet through fiber optic cables that they're installing directly to your house, their so-called Fios system. So those are the ISPs that people talk about the most, and they're certainly the central focus of the paper. But I would include other entities we don't think about every day. So these very, very large companies that don't really have end-user customers, but instead they serve other ISPs. So there's a company called Level 3. Level 3 will never install a connection to the Internet directly to someone's residence. But what they do is they have contracts with the phone companies and the cable companies, and they carry Internet data through very, very fast connections, sometimes called backbone connections, a little colloquially, to get from one side of the country to the other or across an ocean, for example. There are ISPs who kind of specialize in providing a campus with access to the Internet. There are a couple of ISPs in this country, although not many, that focus on providing wireless Internet connectivity. So these are all the companies that fall under my umbrella of ISP. The important thing to talk about is who does that not include? That it doesn't, that omits everyone who runs a website as their business model. And most importantly, whenever you're talking about privacy, my paper omits a detailed focus on Google. So the number one paper, the question I get about my paper that hopefully we'll get to later in the hour is, why am I so afraid of ISPs? Why am I not afraid of Google? And my quick response is, well, that's not the focus of this paper. I'm not talking about the threat to privacy from Google in this paper, at least not directly.
The ISP, the definition that you use of ISP seems quite broad, and certainly I think identifies entities with which the average consumer wouldn't be familiar. So taking the average consumer, the person who is connecting to the Internet through a cable modem that they get from their local cable company, what kind of interaction will they have with the different kind of entities that you mentioned? What is, if you can identify it, the average path that data will take from the end node of the computer at home to the Internet, quote-unquote?
Right, and so there's a very specific answer, and it's a small black or silver box that virtually everyone listening to this radio show has somewhere in their home. And that's either the cable modem or the DSL modem. That's a piece of hardware that you either buy or you lease from your ISP. That connects to a computer in your house or all of the computers in your house, maybe through a wireless connection. And running out the back of that little box is a, you know, cable connection or a phone line. And that's really the first hop onto the Internet. Over that line, you then travel over phone poles or cables buried in the ground, And your first stop after that is some central switching office, or literally a closet somewhere in your greater neighborhood that has some fast connections connected to even bigger pipes that go throughout that go to the main infrastructure of the ISP. And I, you know, I'll mention that throughout this interview, I'm likely to refer to pipes, which is just, you know, a metaphor for kind of an internet cable.
Or tubes, as Senator Stevens would
call it. A metaphor of the size of the pipe. So a really thin pipe is like that little phone line in your house. You can't really communicate very quickly over that. A very fat pipe isn't literally fat, but it's a fiber optic cable that can carry the communications of thousands or even millions of people. And so that's your direct connection. It's literally through physical hardware. You send and receive. So when you download a web page, you are sending things through that little box somewhere in your house over a cable to your ISP, and then they send it on to the rest of the internet.
Now, when we think about an ISP, there are certain defined roles that an ISP has. So in order to, I think, get to the concerns that you raise, I think a basic understanding of what the ISP is doing that is directly, in your view, related to that basic task of allowing you access to the internet versus what it might be doing, which is the focus of your paper, that we may not be aware of. So let's start, if we can, with the basic role of the ISP. What should, in your view, the ISP be doing as a necessity to achieve their task?
So in the purest sense, right, when we're only talking about what must an ISP do, an ISP really has one core reason to exist. It routes. What do I mean by that? Well, basically, whenever you want to download something or upload something onto the internet, because the ISP is the first hop, they're also kind of like the traffic cop, and they decide how to get your communication one step closer to where you want it to go. So let's say you want to visit the New York Times webpage. You will send information to your ISP that's basically a request that will be addressed in some sense to the New York Times. And your ISP's goal there is to decide, how do I get this request one step closer to the New York Times? And the way it does it is buried in a lot of technical detail that we really don't need to get into. But basically, you should think about it as your ISP holding the cable in its right hand and holding the cable in its left hand. They both go to some part of the rest of the internet. When it gets your communication that says, I want the New York Times, all it has to do is decide, is the right hand or the left hand likelier to get it to the New York Times faster? And that's what we call in the network world routing. They may have more than two cables. They may have 15 connections to the internet. But they need to scrutinize your request, see that you want the New York Times, and then decide which pathway out of its facility it needs to take. And in a pure kind of platonic ideal sense, that's all an ISP needs to do, right? That's the beginning, the end, everything. But in reality, that's not quite the way the market works. We want our ISP to do much more.
And just to use some terminology that with which many listeners may be familiar, we're talking about, as compared to smart, the dumb part of, if you will, of the internet connection. Am I right?
Yeah. So in the net neutrality debate, you'll often hear this reference to smart pieces and dumb pieces of the internet. And so in a strict network neutrality sense, yeah, we're talking about the dumb part here. That's when they talk about the dumb network, they're talking about routing, really. The decisions about left hand or right hand. That's what they're talking about.
Now, in your piece, as we dive into it, you refer to the body of scholarship that exists, and it's interesting, again, to frame the issue, because you talk about the various threats, and you mentioned it just recently, not only to privacy from Google, but you also mentioned in your paper, just to list all of these different kinds of threats. You mentioned data aggregators, hackers, spyware authors, identity thieves, and the government. And we see this list, and, you know, we could probably keep going with more names, and it just sounds like this, you know, this group of rogues that are floating out there attempting to threaten our privacy. So you frame the article at the very top level by saying the rise and fall of invasive ISP surveillance, and note that the ISP, in your view, is the gravest threat to privacy in, I guess, based upon all of these different lists, any other possible threat that we could conceive of involving technology. So from a very top level, so that we have basically that conclusion in place, how do you go about making that claim? And I'm not asking you to, of course, recite the entire paper now, but to sum it up, what would you say? What backs up that basic conclusion?
Right, and before we get into it, I think, you know, the most important, not even clarification, because I was very intentional in the way I wrote that first sentence, nothing in society poses as grave a threat. But I did want to, you know, put on the record, because I've gotten some flack from people who work for ISPs, I did want to put on the record that this paper is very much trying to be a canary in a coal mine. And it's trying to talk about maybe not the immediate present, certainly not the recent past, but what I see is the very, very likely future of Internet ISP behavior. And so I'm sensitive to the fact that when I'm trying to make a prediction about the future, it's very important I try and do so rigorously and with claims that I can back up and with evidence I can support. And so the argument I make here is that in the near term, if trends that I've identified continue unabated, the ISPs will do more privacy harm than everything in that list. And so to begin, I mean, it's almost a logic puzzle. The basic idea is think again about that little box sitting somewhere in your house. That box is, you know, in literal terms, network people often call it the gateway. So that's the gateway. Nothing that you do on your computer on the Internet can get onto the Internet except through that one spot. It's a choke point. It's a bottleneck. And your ISP, in its dutiful, dumb network, day-to-day role, will route that all over the place. But if they have the incentive to look at the data, to look at what you're doing, then think about what they can and cannot see. Because they're the gateway, they get to see everything. If you go to Google, they get to see what you do on Google. If you go to YouTube, they see what you do on YouTube. If you go to Facebook, they see what you do on Facebook. Mm-hmm. And when I say they see what you do, I mean that in a very deep sense. They can see not only the messages you post, but the time and date with which you post them. There's almost no Internet activity that's invisible to your ISP, assuming they want to look. Mm-hmm. And if they do want to look, then I think it follows pretty naturally that the threat they pose is certainly more than the threat posed by Google, and I would argue even more than these hackers and spyware authors and identity thieves. And so it's the gateway nature, it's the bottleneck nature that's kind of the essence of what I'm talking about.
And you raise an interesting point, which again is reflected in the title, The Rise and Fall, that we're not fully there yet in terms of the maximum, if you will, threat to privacy that ISPs could pose, in your view. And you mentioned this idea of deep packet inspection, what you call DPI tools, and these tools being on the rise in ISPs. So let's talk in a little more detail again about these ISPs and then get into what's actually happening. What is DPI, and how does that ultimately amplify your concerns?
Yeah, and so recently in a blog post, the way I put this, and I may incorporate this into my paper, I said that ISPs have the opportunity, means, and motive to violate more privacy than any other entity in our lives. And opportunity, we've just discussed. They're your gateway. So now we're on to means. And the essential piece here is it's quite easy. It's actually easier than it's been in the past decade for your Internet service provider to use a specialized piece of hardware with a specialized piece of software to at least analyze every single bit of information leaving your computer and returning to your computer. So Internet network engineers like to talk about how Internet communications get broken up into small pieces called packets. These packets flow through Internet computers. They already were. They were flowing through ISP computers for the routing function. But if the ISP installs a little bit of extra software, and the software is often referred to as deep packet inspection software, DPI, or sometimes it's referred to as a packet sniffer, they can look at every piece of information, and they can take action on every piece of information. And when I mean every piece of information, I mean the entire thing, the content, the addressing information, everything. So this technology has existed for a long time. There's nothing new about it. But what has changed in the last 10 years is it was hard for computers to keep up with the speed of network communication, right? So think about, you know, the big images that you're downloading on your computer. Think about, in these days, the videos that you're streaming to your computer. And then multiply that by every other person in your neighborhood, and then multiply that by every person in your city who's connected to a particular ISP. And you'll see that we now have a fire hose of information targeted at your ISP every second of the day. 10 years ago, network engineers would have said, that's too much information. We can't keep up. The deep packet inspection tool exists, and if I wanted to turn it on and target Dave Levine's connection, I could probably keep up using a powerful computer. But there's no way I'm going to do deep packet inspection on the entire neighborhood or the entire city. Mm-hmm. What I trace in excruciating detail in the paper is how computers for the past decade have gotten faster at a rate exceeding how fast networks have gotten. So in this race between network speed and computer processing speed, the computers are winning. And as a result, that same network engineer, I'm guessing if you ask him today, would say, no, it's not easy for us to monitor everyone in this neighborhood or city, but it's certainly within the realm of possibility. If you give me enough money and let me build a big enough system, I'll be able to intercept all of that information. And 10 years ago, they wouldn't have been able to make that claim. So that's the means. There's certainly, it's easier for them to do that today than it used to be.
We're talking to Professor Paul Ohm of University of Colorado Boulder School of Law, author of a fascinating article available on SSRN called The Rise and Fall of Invasive ISP Surveillance. You're listening to Hearsay Culture on KZSU-FM Stanford. And for those of you that listen regularly, you know that KZSU is a nonprofit, non-commercial radio station at Stanford University that relies on donations from listeners like you to continue its diverse programming. If you would like to make a donation to KZSU, you have a couple of options. You can either click on Donate to KZSU on KZSU's webpage, which is at kzsu.stanford.edu. Again, kzsu.stanford.edu. Or alternatively, you can email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Again, underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Regardless of what you do, I do hope that you continue to listen to KZSU, and I hope that you seriously consider making a donation to the station. So we're back with Professor Paul Ohm from University of Colorado Boulder. Paul, let's when we get into the means here, as you've discussed, you know, a question that kind of you know, I think jumps out or will jump out to some listeners is this issue of, do we care at the top level? The focus of your paper largely is privacy, and I guess I'll ask the question this way. If an ISP never does anything more with the data than collects it and uses it internally, is there any reason for the average consumer to be concerned about that behavior?
Well, the key phrase in your question, I think, is uses it internally.
Mm-hmm.
So it really turns, I think, our answer to that question of should the average consumer care or will the average consumer care, I think it really does turn on how they're using it. And so, you know, let me give you some examples. The one that animates my paper and the one that's been in the press the most is they want to turn your web surfing habits into advertising. And so the question is, does that offend you? Maybe, maybe not, right? So if you visit a lot of travel websites, you may begin to see more travel ads online. Does that offend you? It's hard to say. For some people, I'm sure it does. For others, I'm sure it doesn't. But step it up. So AT&T has recently said on numerous occasions that they would like to begin experimenting with the technology for filtering Internet traffic to look for people trading copyrighted content. In other words, they want to be the surveillance arm of the recording industry or the motion picture industry. Do we care about that? I'm sure more people do. And then, it really becomes an exercise in imagination, and also are ISPs likely to give in to certain claims? So do we want it to be easy for them to assist the government in their investigations, to look for child pornography or maybe ordinary pornography? So I think the answer really turns, but I think at bottom the answer has to be that for almost everybody, we can imagine a scenario that would alarm us and that we would consider a privacy violation. Then it just becomes a discussion of, is that scenario likely to happen?
Yes, and actually we will talk in a few minutes about market effects and whether that alone poses the best check on these concerns. Let's take one more top-level question to get into that, which, of course, the existence of regulation on ISP. So what is the state of the law, either law or regulation from administrative level, on dealing with these privacy and data collection issues?
And it's that question that makes me the most pleased that I'm able to kind of reach a generalist audience, because for people who think a little bit about this, and surprisingly for people who think a lot about this, they think the answer to your question, the question being what's legal and illegal for an ISP to do online, they think the answer is it's their network and they can do with it what they please. It's their network and they can do whatever they want with it. But that's not the state of the law at all. So there's a law that I spent all of my years at Department of Justice mastering and studying and learning about called the Electronic Communications Privacy Act. It has three different sections. The most interesting for this discussion is the Wiretap Act. So this is the same law that makes it a federal felony to stick a tape recorder surreptitiously on someone's voice phone. It's the law that makes it illegal to run a packet sniffer or deep packet inspection tool in certain circumstances. And so the answer is, well, based on what I've said already, don't ISPs violate this law every day? Not necessarily, because there are many exceptions to the law that are specifically designed to allow providers to do their jobs. But the important point I really try and convey in my paper, and I think is missed too often in this debate, is none of the exceptions in the law are get-out-of-jail-free blanket immunity provisions. There are exceptions that I would argue are actually somewhat narrow, and there is a lot of room in there for a judge, for example, if an ISP gets sued by its customers, there's a lot of room in there for a judge to say, you know what, you crossed the line. You crossed the line and you owe damages to your customers. Maybe in extreme circumstances, you crossed the line and you committed a federal crime. So there are constraints, but the Electronic Communications Privacy Act, by all accounts, is one of the most confusing federal statutes going. I like to joke in my class that, you know, I'd go one-on-one with a tax scholar any day to see who has the most confusing statute. And so there's a lot of ambiguity, vagueness, and open questions in that law about where these lines are. And I think the ISPs are taking advantage of this ambiguity to play a lot in the gray area, because courts haven't really said that they shouldn't cross into that area yet.
Now, you in a portion of the paper where you this really frame the discussion, but also talk about why we should be concerned about these issues, which obviously is a big focus of this show and dovetails with your goals and your scholarship. You say that for a variety of reasons, you see the monitoring of network activity increasing in terms of literally you expect ISPs to do more of this and not less. From a privacy perspective, though, it would seem that there would be a market check on this, which basically boils down to if the ISP reveals the most sensitive information that might that any individual might send through the internet, so whether it's nefarious things or whether it's things that literally would be embarrassing or worse to an individual, or whether it's financial data, for example, isn't the market itself the best check on making sure that this doesn't happen? Now, we can't correct for negligence, we can't correct for errors, but is it not the case that if an ISP decides that it's going to reveal information of that nature to a third party without the consent of the individual, that the reaction from the consumers that use that service is, wow, I don't want to use this anymore because my data isn't secure?
And so this is probably, I would say, the animating central debate in all of information privacy law, which is, shouldn't we just leave it to the market, because that's what we so often do in law and policy. And it's kind of hand-in-hand with a frustration that many scholars feel that people don't care more and that they don't vote with their wallets when it comes to things like information privacy invasions. And so I've got many responses in the particular context of ISPs. The first and the most obvious is, in your question just now, you kept talking about this moment where the public becomes aware of the downstream use that they would otherwise not like. And of course, there's inherent in a lot of this information asymmetry, where the information is flowing and we really don't know about it, and we don't have any reason to know about it. There's no mandatory disclosure under federal law that ISPs talk about how they use our data. Sure, they may mention in our privacy policies that they intend to do something rather aggressive and unprecedented, but how many people are reading those? And even if they do read them, the terms are likely to be kind of buried in legalese. And so, you know, just as a premise matter, I'm not even sure that people are learning about it. Secondly, there are quite a few interesting scholars who are writing about how we make cognitive mistakes that make it difficult for us to value privacy in the way we ordinarily would. So this is the age-old debate that always happens about how if you ask someone in a vacuum, do you value privacy? The answer is always yes. It's essential. It's one of the values that I hold most dear. But then if you put them in an applied situation where you offer to give them a piece of chocolate for their password, which is a real British study, an overwhelming number of them will do it. And there are lots of reasons, and that's not exactly my area of expertise, but there are lots of reasons, looking at sociology and psychology, to suggest why people are making what I guess I would call a mistake in that situation. But the third one, the one that doesn't come up when it comes to something like a website but comes up in ISPs, is market power. So in most cities in America, there's a duopoly of ISP broadband providers. And by broadband, I just mean fast connections as opposed to the old days of slow modems. Mm-hmm. So it's your cable company or your phone company. In some parts of the country, you don't even have that choice. You only have one choice to get on the Internet. And, you know, the increasing thing I'm hearing among technology snobs is, in some cases, we've considered the cable modem providers to be the winners because they've been able to provide more bandwidth than the phone company. So even though I may have two choices, I realistically only have one. And so even if you are outraged at what your ISP has done, even if you wish you could walk with your wallet, there's often nowhere to walk. So for all these reasons, I don't have a lot of faith in the ISP market sorting this all out. And I am happy that a federal law exists that may help regulate this behavior.
The paper focuses on ISP surveillance. And we live in a society right now where surveillance is obviously seems to be on the rise. And it also seems that the public is more willing to allow themselves to be surveilled. With regard to one of the hot topics of today, national security, is there a pushback? Is there a motivation, do you think, among the ISP community that literally this boils down to, we need to make sure that we don't run afoul of law enforcement? And in connection with the lawsuit that I mentioned at the beginning and the other interactions that you've mentioned, and certainly those with which you're familiar based upon your background, is there a concern among the ISP community that almost they have no choice? They must be doing this behavior. They must increase their capability to monitor this traffic because law enforcement and others are going to demand that from them.
Yeah, there certainly is. I mean, that pressure, you know, and a big part of my paper is just describing pressures on providers.
Right.
And a significant point of pressure is this idea that we need to build more surveillance capability in our networks because the government is going to demand it. I mean, you even hear a more aggressive form of that, which is it's a matter of patriotism, that in order to make sure that we're helping find terrorists, we need to have a network that the government can monitor. I have, by way of full disclosure, although I worked for the Department of Justice in my first year as a law professor, I assisted the Electronic Frontier Foundation in that litigation against EFF, although I'm not part of the team right now. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, that's certainly one of the points of pressure. You know, in this paper, because the national security issue is such a big piece, I kind of barely mention it. I talk a little bit about CALEA, which is the Communications Assistance for Law Enforcement Act, which basically says, doesn't say anything about when ISPs need to help the government wiretap, but it does say that in order for you to be the most help on that future day when we do need to wiretap your network, you need to install technology that can be wiretapped easily. Mm-hmm. And so, yes, that's exactly one of the main reasons that providers are experimenting with this technology and installing that technology.
You discuss anonymity throughout your paper, and it's something, again, that I think ties into this concern as we establish, really ultimately establish your baseline claim, which is that this is the biggest threat. And we talk about online advertising, and I guess this ties into some of the issues involving Google that you referred to earlier. You know, online advertising, at least at surface, seems innocuous enough. Google's identified that I like handbags, and so I'm going to get an ad on the side of my Google search saying, here's a place where you can buy handbags. But you are more concerned about this behavior, and you talk about applications like Form and NebuAd. So perhaps you could discuss this general, you know, ad software, and particularly those types of applications, and how they impact the privacy of users.
Sure. So Form and NebuAd are both American companies, but for business reasons outside my knowledge, Form targets British customers and NebuAd targets American customers. But they have very similar business models. They recognize that there is an untapped market for monitoring, basically surveilling ISP customers, and then with the information they learn about each customer, selling that behavioral information to third-party advertisers, taking the money that they receive for the advertising and splitting it with the ISP. So this is all technology ISPs could have developed in-house, but Form and NebuAd have stepped in to fill what they see as kind of a hole in the market. And they basically say, ISP, hire us. We'll come into your facility, install a bunch of hardware. There's literally Form servers. Plug your cable into our server, and we'll siphon off just enough information so that your customers will start to see targeted ads. Targeted ads are more valuable ads. Advertisers will pay more for them, and so that's why this is a really lucrative business model. It's taken more hold in the UK than it has in the US. Form has contracts with several providers, British Telecom being one, where they have an agreement that they'll begin to monitor customers in this way. In both the UK and the US, there was a significant backlash to the attempted rollout of these two things. Because remember, ISPs had never monitored their users for this purpose before. It was a brand new business model. Basically, what they were doing is turning user secrets into cash, because they were, frankly, jealous that Google has this huge pot of revenue source that they do not. And so that's the way it worked. The story, as you indicated at the start of your question, that Form and NebuAd always tell is about anonymization. So they will say, look, we've engineered this thing, we've architected this thing to make sure that we'll never know that you visited website X, website Y, and website Z. All we'll know is that all three of those websites have something to do with travel, for example. And so we'll peg you as someone who should see more travel ads, but no one, not the government, no one else, not the ISP, they won't be able to use our data alone to reverse engineer the fact that you went to a particular website. That's their claim.
The concern that you mentioned at the beginning, and I think this is a good time to discuss in the remaining 10 minutes or so that we have, is that very question. What you're describing seems, okay, I could see why, you know, I think the average consumer might be concerned, but to put the push back, and I'll really ask the question, it's about the biggest softball I can ask because, because you identified the question, but yeah, why not be more concerned about search engines? About Google being able to do more than the ISP and perhaps want to do more than the ISP potentially or have less of an obligation to protect our privacy?
So there's several ways I can answer that question. I mean, I think as an absolute empirical matter, Google collects much more information and does much more behavioral targeting and analysis than your ISP today. And so in that case, if anyone walks away after reading my paper and thinks ISP should be regulated, Google should not, and that's his bottom line, that's not where I intended to go with the paper. Frankly, the question of the threat to privacy from Google is one that I haven't focused on in any of my work. I think the structure that I lay out in this paper for helping policymakers measure things like threats to privacy would probably conclude that Google is a threat and should probably be regulated more than they are today. So by no means do I want to suggest that they're a free pass. I think ISPs are really a fascinating thing to look at because there's a shifting landscape in ISP surveillance that just doesn't exist in Google. Google, I mean, to put a really fine point on it, they've invaded our privacy in the ways I'm describing since their inception, right? I mean, their AdSense and AdWords programs were created pretty early in the history of Google, and they've turned user secrets into money from the very beginning. There was no kind of decision they made at some point to change the status quo. ISPs, on the other hand, I think are at this moment where they're tempted and threatening to shift the status quo considerably. And I think shifts like that in privacy from what we expect to what we have are moments when policymakers really need to be extra attentive, right? If it's true, and you know what really started me down the path of this paper is reading the newspaper. Every month of this year, there was a new ISP putting feelers out there, testing a new theory of turning secrets into cash. And I was alarmed by that. So I saw this wave, and I thought, this is a great moment for me to focus on this, and this is a great moment for policymakers to start talking about this. And so I guess, you know, I mean, a cynic can listen to what I just said and say, well, Google's been a problem for so long, we might as well ignore them. That's not at all what I'm saying. But I think that the nature's different. And then when you layer on top of all of that, what I said earlier about how if the ISPs really wanted to, if they really wanted to flip that switch, they would become a threat the likes of which Google can't even touch. I stand by that absolutely. Right, let me crystallize that last point with sure. One example.
Okay.
You can always hide from Google, right? You can always decide to go to the New York Times, to go to MSNBC, to go to Yahoo. Now, I know some of your listeners are throwing things at the radio because, number one, Google has merged with DoubleClick, which means their vision of the Internet is much broader than it used to be. Number two, Google is in the works, perhaps, of merging some of its advertising deals with Yahoo. So it's true that Google is trying all it can to have the same sort of vision of the Internet that your ISP already has. And because of their market power, strength, and ability to merge, maybe someday they'll have the same potential view as your ISP, but not today. Today, it's so easy. All your ISP has to do is flip the packet sniffer switch, flip the DPEC and inspection switch, and they've got it all. And you can never hide from it. They're just omnipresent. So
with that alarming statement, and it is alarming, and I share a lot of your concerns. Let's get in the remaining few minutes that we have to talk about some of your prescriptions for dealing with this problem. So you naturally, and not surprisingly, given the concerns that you raise, call for more regulation of ISPs. So literally, I at this point in the show, I always ask an unfair question. So literally, in the remaining about 4 minutes that we have, an overview of how we deal with this problem. What do you propose?
And I hope, I'm glad you used the word alarming and not alarmist.
I purposely chosen.
So you know, the good news, and you don't often see this in a law paper, the good news is my core prescription, the number one thing they say we need in this situation, is we just need to enforce the law we have. So this isn't a paper where I try and construct a broad new class of regulation that applies to ISPs. And in fact, that's part of why this topic interested me, because I saw a disconnect between the law and the books and the behavior of a particular class of people. And so what we need, quite frankly, is we need for there to be more plaintiffs' class action lawsuits that allege wiretap violations. There are certainly financial incentives for doing that. You get $100 per victim per day, or $10,000 per victim total, for violating the Wiretap Act. So imagine the number of customers that a particular regional ISP has, and multiply that by those numbers, and you have a huge verdict potentially there. Why do I want suits? It's not just to make the lives of executives at ISPs much more difficult. It's for two reasons. One, it's to clarify these legal questions that we simply cannot answer, because it's that gray area of unanswered question that allows these people, emboldens ISPs to act. But secondly, I think there'll be a healthy sense of deterrence, right? All it takes is a couple of these lawsuits, and then the internal memos from lawyers at ISPs will begin to change their tone. they'll begin to say, sure, there's an envelope here. We really shouldn't push the envelope. We should really respect user privacy more, because it's just, as a cost-benefit proposition, not a good bet, that we don't want to face any more of these civil lawsuits. You know, and I go in the paper to say that maybe there are ways we can make these laws more robust in this situation. In particular, the ISPs, their number one argument will be that, well, every one of our users has consented to monitoring for any purpose because it says so in our privacy policy. I don't know whether that's a good argument or not under the law, so I advise Congress to maybe go back and try and shore up the way consent is construed under the statute.
Well, certainly, and as someone who teaches contracts, one of the lingering issues are these EULAs, end user license agreements, and so forth, that purport to bind individuals in a variety of ways, and I share your skepticism about those. The paper is fascinating, and certainly one that I think is accessible both to experts, certainly, as well as to lay people. The Rise and Fall of Invasive ISP Surveillance. The author is Paul Ohm, Associate Professor of Law and Telecommunications at the University of Colorado Law School. Paul, I know that you are an active blogger, and I think I'd be remiss in not mentioning that. For people that want to come into contact with more of your thoughts and writing, where can they find more information?
So I have posted quite a bit about this article in particular at concurringopinions.com, where I was a guest blogger. And in the last 2 weeks, I've actually signed on to blog permanently at the freedomtotinker.com. That's freedom-to-tinker.com, which is run by Ed Felton at Princeton University.
And I'm a reader of both blogs, and I'm familiar with Ed Felton's work. Do you have a prediction, or at least maybe a forecast for what kind of blogging you plan on doing on Freedom to Tinker?
Yeah, I mean, you know, most law professors blog to law professors, and I think Freedom to Tinker is going to give me this amazing opportunity to interact with who I think are kind of my core readership, which is computer scientists. I just want to test my crazy ideas in that forum. So I've already posted one thing about ISP surveillance, and I'm sure I'll do more, but it'll also be about computer security. Maybe I'll have something to say about the Sarah Palin email hack. And so information privacy defined pretty broadly. I'm looking forward to that. And then I'll add paulohm.com, because I'm a very 21st century guy, is where you can find links to all of these articles and other things about me.
Terrific. Well, Paul, thank you for joining me today on Hearsay Culture and for benefiting the listeners of this show with a discussion of really this very important issue and your article. Thank you for joining us today.
It was my pleasure. Thanks a lot, Dave. I enjoyed it.
Thank you. I'm looking forward to having a number of interesting guests coming up on Hearsay Culture, guests that span the IP and technology world. Among the guests, in no particular order, Nick Carr, author of the book The Big Switch, which has a new edition coming out next year. Professor Ned Snow from the University of Arkansas Law School, who will be coming on discussing fair use issues and copyright. Clay Shirky, the author of Here Comes Everybody, will be coming on the show later in the year. Interesting piece by Michael Gollan, Driving Innovation, focusing on how companies can marshal intellectual property rights. Morel Hildebrandt, editor, one of the editors of a book put out by Springer called Profiling the European Citizen, tying in directly to not only Paul's work, but also Dan Solov's work and others, previous guests on Hearsay Culture that have discussed privacy issues. David Rice, author of Geekonomics, will be on the show later in the year. Mark Barreline, author of the book The Dumbest Generation, taking a much dimmer view of technology than just about anyone that I've had on the show thus far. Andrew Lumen and Wendy Seltzer will be on discussing the Tor project, another privacy and anonymity area, focusing on the use of Tor servers, kind of a controversial area within Internet architecture, and we're going to be exploring the issues that they deal with. Paul Heald from University of Georgia will be on discussing his work, as well as John Palfrey from Harvard Law School, who's co-authored a book with Urs Gasser called Born Digital. Jeff Howe from Wired magazine, who's authored the book Crowdsourcing, they're tying in also to Clay's work, Here Comes Everybody, dealing with social networking as well as peer production, and that's a topic that we've discussed extensively on Hearsay Culture with Michelle Bowens from the Peer-to-Peer Foundation, as well as Professor Larry Lessig and others, and Bob Wallace and H.K. Melton, who have written a fascinating book called Spycraft, focusing on technology uses by the intelligence agencies, particularly as both of them were high-level people at the Central Intelligence Agency, discussing the use of technology by the CIA. So I'm very excited to have these guests coming on the show. I'm looking forward to booking more guests on the show beginning into next year. Most of the guests that I've just mentioned will be on the show throughout the remaining part of 2008, so I am booking programs now for the beginning of 2009. If you are aware of any guests that you think would be good guests for Hearsay Culture, and of course for comments generally, I would love to hear from you. You can email me at dave@hearsayculture.com. Again, dave@hearsayculture.com. And as always, there are a number of ways to pick up Hearsay Culture. You can listen to it, of course, live on KZSU Wednesdays at 5 p.m. Pacific by going to either 90.1 FM in the Bay Area, or by going to kzsulive.stanford.edu and streaming the show. You can also get the show through hearsayculture.com, where you'll find the schedule as well as all previous shows. The iTunes page for the Center for Internet Society at Stanford Law School also has Hearsay Culture. And last but not least, the RSS feed from cyberlaw.stanford.edu, which is the homepage for the Center for Internet Society. Thank you for listening to Hearsay Culture today. Thank you for listening to KZSU. And please stay tuned to further diverse programming on KZSU FM Stanford. Have a great day.